Today on Political Rewind, members of Georgia's congressional delegation spar over William Barr and the continuing reverberations from the Mueller report. A Gwinnett County GOP stalwart may change parties to win re-election. Johnny Isaacson urges President Trump not to impose tariffs on auto imports. Political Rewind starts now. Hey, everybody. Thanks for being with us for Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. Let's get right to our panel so we can start talking about the stories in the news this week. Jim Galloway is with us. He, of course, is the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. His column appears on Wednesdays and Sundays in the AJC, and he oversees the Political Insider blog at AJC.com. Before we introduce the rest of the panel, let's do a quick promotion for you. We've talked about the fact that Judge Robert Benham, the longest-serving justice on the state Supreme Court and the first African-American on the state Supreme Court, has announced he's not going to run for re-election. He's got some time left. You really dug up some great nuggets and interviewed him for your column.
Yeah, we had a great time together. Yeah. And it's up online. You can find it right now.
I was trying to sell papers for Sunday, Galloway.
Well, yeah, but I need the page views.
That's
too.
Right. You need click-throughs. I get it. Anyhow, it's a really interesting piece. Maybe we'll talk briefly about Benham before the show is over. Buddy Darden is with us today. He's the former Democratic congressman from the 7th District, which used to be Cobb County and precincts north all the way. You went all the way up to the Tennessee line, yeah.
I went from Atlanta city limits to the Chattanooga city limits.
Yeah.
But now it's mainly the 11th.
Yeah, that's the 11th. It's Barry
Loudermilk's
district now. Mm-hmm. Glad to have you back with
Glad
us.
Glad to be back. Thank you.
Buddy. Dr. Andra Gillespie, political science professor from Emory University, is back with us today. Her new book on Barack Obama is now out. We really enjoyed the show we got to do with you on that book.
I enjoyed it, too. Thank you.
And you're just about finished with school.
Almost.
You gave your last exam of the semester already?
Yes, gave my final exam yesterday.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Emory graduated.
I just have to grade it.
Well, yeah. And Eric Tanenblatt is back with us today. Of course, he's a longtime Republican operative in Georgia. He's raised countless amounts of money for Republican candidates, for president, for statewide office, for friends of his from across the country. George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush were beneficiaries of your wisdom and your abilities as a fundraiser. You work with Mitt Romney. You've got great credentials, Tanenblatt.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, we're glad to have you here as well. All right, let's start, if we can, Jim, with the latest. I mean, obviously, the political news out of Washington was dominated by the hearings, the Judiciary Committee hearing in the Senate on Wednesday, William Barr coming in and talking to senators, some of whom were very skeptical about what Barr had to say about the Mueller report and how he put together his findings. Some were, in fact, completely supportive of him. We won't go into that. People have already seen enough of it. But yesterday, Barr was expected to testify in the House Judiciary Committee. And he declined to show up because he was not happy with the arrangement that the Democratic chair of that committee, Gerald Nadler, wanted to put in place, which was not only would members of the committee get to interview Barr, but he wanted staff attorneys to also be part of the interviews. Now, we tend to talk about Georgia news on this show, and so there's a reason we're addressing it now, and that's our own Doug Collins, who really was, again, a big defender of Donald Trump committee yesterday.
Again, he's the ranking Republican on the House Judiciary Committee. Lucy McBath is on that same committee. So we have representation here. Well, it was interesting. There were two things, I think, behind the House move. That which was heavily criticized by Mr. Collins. I think they wanted a committee counsel to question Mr. Barr for two reasons. Number one, you get more consistent question, more follow up. Mm-hmm. You're not chopping your interrogators into 5 minute sound bits where they make speeches and such. So you're actually getting more information. But as we saw with the Kavanaugh hearing, it also insulates the leadership of the House committee from any blowback from that questioning, which I think is an underlying reason for that too.
So I want to open it up to the panel, but before we do, let's look at what Doug Collins had to say. Again, the Attorney General said he would not appear in this committee because he didn't like the format of having to answer questions of staff attorneys. He said he was willing to talk to members themselves. Nadler, in his remark, they met yesterday. It was a dog and pony show to the extent that they knew that the Attorney General wasn't going to be there. They had his place set. They had his name card out. But the Democrats who control the committee knew all along he wouldn't be there. Nadler, of course, attacked Barr for not showing up. And then Doug Collins had his chance as the ranking member of the committee to respond. So let's listen.
But yet we spent approved a motion yesterday that said we could do a whole hour, an extra hour. Between the chairman and myself, he could have took one of these fabulous members that he has, and he has some excellent attorneys on his side, some of the best. He could have given them all 30 minutes, and they could have questioned the Attorney General any way they wanted to. Instead, we go back to a circus political stunt to say we want it to look like an impeachment hearing. Because they won't bring impeachment proceedings. That's the reason. Take whatever you want to take. You can go out and have press conferences. You can say it from this dais. You can say whatever you want to have. But the reason Bill Barr is not here today is because the Democrats decided they didn't want him here today.
Doug Collins, Anna Gillespie, no matter which side you're on this fight, Doug Collins has been a strong defender of President Trump. And what's interesting about him is he can be incredibly partisan as he was there, but he's so very well liked up there because of the kind of person they all think he is. It was that way when he was in the General Assembly here as well, but he's really making a name for himself in that role.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's what comes with sort of the privilege of being the ranking member of a really sort of high-ranked and highly visible committee. You know, I think if we were to look at the charges of gamesmanship, I think this is one of those places where the moral equivalence actually really does apply. And so Congressman Collins can claim that they may have been pulling a stunt or they were trying to back Attorney General Barr into a corner, but the reality of it is that, you know, by them saying you're trying to make this look like Watergate instead of having the guts to impeach, you're also attempting to try to play a card in that particular vein. And if this is the case, Congress has the right to have oversight over the executive branch. And when the executive branch refuses to comply and refuses to show up and refuses to cooperate, right, Congress has the right to be able to say so.
Yeah. Eric, buddy?
Well, this hearing that was scheduled had been held, Hawaii didn't show. Would have been a partisan hearing. I'm sure there would have been a lot of people tagging the Attorney General. At the same time, he also skated the day before when he was over at the Senate. So the Senate's all for him, and the House is probably all against him. But that's part of the give and take. And I think the Attorney General, I think in order to preserve his reputation and to get back into the political mainstream where he previously has been, he needs to go ahead and show up and just take his lumps just like everybody else. He's a big boy. He can handle himself. And he doesn't need to be put in a situation of saying, hey, I'm not going to do it unless they play it by my rules. You know, when we came down here today, we agreed to your format, Bill, and that's just kind of the way it works.
Eric. I do think the comment that Doug made about, or Congressman Collins made about political theater is accurate. I mean, there's no reason why elected members of Congress can't question the Attorney General. That's what happened in the Senate. And, you know, people can have their opinions as to what the Attorney General said when he appeared before the Senate. The same thing can happen in the House. And I think that Congressman Collins is absolutely right. Apparently, they agreed to a certain format, and the majority, you know, changed the way that they were going to do it. Now, look, elections have consequences. The Democrats control the House. They, unfortunately, control the committees. And they have the prerogative to do that. But I think Congressman Collins is absolutely right. This is political theater. And unfortunately, with this particular issue, everyone has sort of dug in and has a position.
So all that said, and we can talk a little more about that, but talk a little bit about the position this puts Doug Collins in. How does this elevate his profile? What does his elevated profile mean moving forward? How does this accrue to his benefit or his detriment?
Well, I think he's showing leadership. And,
you know, for someone who has only been in the Congress for, you know, a few years, for him to move up the ranks so quickly, I think speaks volumes to his capabilities. And I think what he did yesterday demonstrates why he is the ranking member of the committee.
But it's a two-way street, because once you identify with being the ranking minority member and staking out the ground so tough and so hard and so intractable, at the same time, then you lose the aura of being somewhat circumspect about looking at things. And so it's going to identify him, for better or for worse, as a pretty serious partisan.
All right. I find that interesting, Jim and Andra, to talk about circumspection in the climate of our Congress today. There's really no such thing anymore. I mean, we all looked at what happened yesterday in the House and the day before in the Senate Judiciary Committee from the partisan lens that we are viewing the world through. So I'm not sure I see the downside that that Buddy does in terms of needing to seem more circumspect.
Well, I think I see both of your points. And so I think on one hand, if we think about the fact that there really isn't a national appetite based on public opinion polls for impeachment hearings, mm-hmm. right? And so what Republicans are banking on is Democrats are going to continually play theater, and they're going to end up looking bad because it just looks like they, you know, they're with like a dog with a bone, and they don't actually want to give up sort of the whole sort of fallout from the Mueller report. On the other hand, I think what Democrats are trying to bank on is that they offer opportunities if they make demands, reasonable demands for oversight, and the administration doesn't comply, then it makes the administration and by extension the Republican Party look like they are lawless and that they have no respect for institutions. And there's also judicial side of this, that these things are going to court, and as these things get litigated, that Republicans might end up losing a few things.
Let me ask you, Buddy. Okay, so you've got the president who has pretty much put a blanket stop on any cooperation with the U.S. House. Okay,
he's just a puppeteer.
Given your experience, how likely is it that the House would retaliate with dollars, with funding, with pulling funding from specific areas, say for the Justice Department or for the White House staffing?
That's a dangerous game. That's a dangerous game, and I think it might be a little bit too obvious. Now, that's the way Trump plays ball, yes, but I don't think the House ought to be led into it as well, because they have a responsibility far beyond Donald Trump. They have a responsibility to the country, and this is not the last president, hopefully, we'll ever have in this country, because the show must go on, our government must go on, and they need to look in terms of the longer view, the longer picture, rather than just the immediate back and forth. I think it'd make the House look, frankly, little and petty if they took measures like that.
Jim, we all know that David Perdue has been one of the closest allies to President Trump on Capitol Hill, and we're going to watch very carefully in 2020 to see whether that serves him well or if, in fact, that becomes a real problem for him moving forward in his reelection campaign. I suppose the same could be said about whether Doug Collins, how far into bed Doug Collins really wants to be with Trump. It feels as if he's on safe ground as long as he's playing his role in judiciary. The question is if he moves beyond that.
Right, and he's got beyond that, he's got a reputation for working well with playing well with Democrats, particularly on things like criminal justice reform. So I think this is one case where to be portrayed as the president's lawyer. And only the president's lawyer probably is okay, as long as you keep that what Buddy was talking about, that sense of integrity.
Yeah, but I also think that, you know, you're looking at this as, you know, Doug's doing this because he's a supporter of the president's, which I believe he is.
No. I specifically said he's playing, certainly in his role in judiciary, he is working on behalf of the president.
Absolutely. And to Buddy's point, I mean, you have to look at the institution. And I think the other thing, Congressman Collins, if you listen to some of the rest of his remarks, he talked about he compared the current chairman of the committee to the former chairman, Sensenbrenner, and how Sensenbrenner conducted himself as the Republican chairman of the committee.
I do think, Andra, I wonder if Democrats, Nadler, are overplaying their hand on this. The day before, if you were a Democrat and watched the Attorney General in the House and the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, you came away with a lot of red meat that you could rally your troops with in terms of what you heard Bill Barr say. I wonder if Nadler didn't lose the opportunity by being so insistent, and Collins refers to this. Mm-hmm. Collins, in his, those remarks, if we'd played more of them, says we would have talked, we could have added an hour to his testimony. So I wonder if by being stubbornly insistent, Nadler, in fact, lost a good opportunity for Democrats.
So I think there are a couple of things here. So I think about this from a methodological standpoint, because I have to admit, I watch congressional hearings and I watch how members of Congress ask questions. And as somebody who does this as part of my research method, I'm like, it sometimes befuddles me sort of how the arc of the questions. And I don't understand why, in terms of sort of each side, like why they can't get together and agree about, okay, you're going to ask questions about this. Mm-hmm. You're going to come up next, and it makes sense to ask these questions here and to kind of keep on going. So I would actually, just from an academic standpoint, recommend a certain type of coordination across members as they're asking questions that could alleviate this problem.
Oh, we got to hear.
Let Andrew finish, and then we'll go to Bunny.
On the other hand, though, there are also other places where Nadler is indicating that he's willing to cooperate with Barr, so that if this ends up in court, he can say that I was an obstructionist the whole time. So in particular, there's a back and forth going on right now, even as we speak, according to the Washington Post, about the redactions and other types of things. So, you know, it looks like, you know, I think they're both trying to figure out sort of where they can compromise and where they can look tough. And I think it's trying to, like, be able to compromise behind the scenes while maintaining this sort of tough posture publicly.
Buddy, you want to respond?
Here's the difference. Dr. Gillespie, you're an academician, and you look at logic and reason. I'm a politician. And politicians don't necessarily always look at it in that respect. And this is exactly playing out like both sides want to play out.
Right.
They'll come together eventually, and they will resolve then. But at the same time, everybody's got to get their licks in, and that's part of being a politician. You're looking at it from a reasonable basis.
Yeah, but she also, she looks at it as the great academician that she is. You as the politician, I'm just a voter. I mean, I hope I'm an informed voter.
You're not exactly just a voter.
Well, my point is, I'm kind of disgusted
but
with the entire
thing. But you are an interviewer,
thing.
And there's a certain arc to how you ask questions in order to elicit responses. And there's some members of Congress who do a great job, both Democratic and Republican, and then there's some people, it's like, why did you ask those questions in that order? You're not going to get the responses that you want just based on how you set the question up.
You know, in anticipation of today's show, I watched last night both Fox News and CNN and MSNBC. Two completely different worlds, the way this was covered.
Yeah, it's crazy. Let's do this, because we had two other members of Georgia's congressional delegation on the Judiciary Committee. They both came to the stakeout position, the microphones, after the hearing or the committee meeting broke up. Let's hear first from Democrat Hank Johnson from the 4th District.
In the 2016 elections, this nation was attacked from outside of its borders by the Russians. As a result of their outside attack, we are now being attacked from the inside by the very Trump administration whom the Russians favored. This is a very dark day and a very dark time for our republic. It is under attack. The worst kind of damage that can be done to America is from its enemies from within. And we have enemies, and we have aiders and abettors of those enemies.
And shortly after Hank Johnson went to the microphone, so did 6th District Congresswoman Lucy McBath.
And we, Congress, have the responsibility as a co-equal branch of government to protect and to serve and to make sure the American people have the facts and the information that they need to make sure that they know that government is truly working on their behalf. And my colleagues and I will continue to stand to fight for the truth, continue to stand for what is right, to make sure that democracy works for each and every individual in this country.
So, Jim, here you go. Both sides, Collins we saw a little earlier, now McBath and Johnson, getting what they want out of what happened yesterday, which essentially was nothing.
My only problem is that I didn't get what I wanted.
Which is
a clear and concise answer to some very specific
questions
about what was in the Mueller report.
That was my point.
But it got down to an argument of process versus substance. And what Doug Collins and Jerry Nadler were doing were arguing about process. Those comments from Hank Johnson and McBath were talking about more of the substance. We didn't even get to the substance because of the processed arguments that were going on between the chair and the ranking member.
I think that's right. Andra, we're going to move on beyond this, but I want to throw out an idea to you and see if it resonates at all. As we've already discussed, and as anybody who's paying attention knows, the White House is being entirely intransigent, fighting the Democrats on the Hill in every way they can, refusing to let people testify, ignoring requests for material, subpoenas for material. They simply refuse to work with the Democrats in Congress. This is the sort of thing that under, I think, normal circumstances, we might think is outrageous behavior. But here's what I'm wondering. Are we so lacking in civics education that the American people just really, and I don't mean Trump, I'm not talking Trump people and looking down on anyone. I'm just saying we don't teach civics anymore. I'm not sure people understand the co-equal branches of government, how important it is that we have them, that Congress has a crucial role. I wonder if we just don't quite grasp that in the way that we probably ought to, whether we're Democrats or Republicans. Does that make sense?
So here are a couple of working hypotheses. You're probably right, but I don't necessarily know if I would blame all of this on the lack of civics education, though I would be a big proponent of making sure that there's clear civics education. I think the issue is that people remember their civics education when it is convenient for them to do so. And given our level of political polarization, there are people who only want to bring up rules and process when their party is the one that's actually being hurt by the situation. And so the thing that I worry about is I worry about the fact that you don't have moderates of either party kind of in the chamber to be the voice of reason, and also to actually be the defenders of decorum. To say, like, I'm going to look at Congressman Johnson's comments, and I know personally he is a very nice man, but there was some othering going on there. Like, we have enemies from within, right? Like, that type of language, even though there are a lot of people who I think have good reasons to be sympathetic to it, that's also the kind of language that actually makes it harder for people to be able to come together, and I think that that's also part of the problem.
That makes sense to me.
Then there's the KFC, too.
That type of theater was definitely sort of a little
Steve,
bit interesting. Cohen of Tennessee.
Yeah, from Tennessee with his, and then yesterday he had a porcelain chicken sitting on Bill Barr's seat in the hearing room. You know, buddy, this
is unnecessary.
Well, Bill,
let's just go back to the real situation, because William Barr, the Attorney General, is playing not to the American public, not to the Congress, not to the House, the Senate. He's playing to one person, and that's Donald Trump. And as long as Donald Trump is happy and commends what he's doing and likes what he's seeing, then he's okay. He can skate, and he knows he's doing exactly what the president would have him do.
All right, we're going to watch how this unfolds. And again, we will keep an eye on especially Doug Collins as all of this moves forward. It's fascinating to have a Georgia congressman in such a high-profile position with all of this. Let's do this. Let's get our first break of the show out of the way. And then I would love to ask the panel about just what they think about some developments in Gwinnett County that show us more clearly than ever how much that county has been changing. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Taya Ryan, President and CEO of GPB. We've been hearing from listeners across Georgia and beyond thanking us for GPB's Stealth Drive, the new less intrusive fundraising approach you've been hearing about. We hoped that listeners like you would appreciate getting more programming and less fundraising so much that we'd see the same level of support that comes in during a traditional fund drive. Here's where we're at. We've passed the halfway mark for the number of days of the drive. However, we have not yet reached the halfway mark in terms of the funding that sustains the services GPB provides. We're counting on you now to support the programs that matter to you and keep traditional on-air fundraising days this spring to a minimum. Donate online at gpb.org or call 1-800-222-4788. Thank you for supporting GPB.
We're back on Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, if we needed any proof still that Gwinnett County is trending Democratic, we really need look no further than a report that 11 Lives Doug Richards first broke yesterday. He was talking to Danny Porter, the DA who's been in that position for more than two decades.
Six terms.
a Republican DA. He told Doug that he thinks he wants to run for one last term, but...
he might do it as a Democrat.
Wow. Wow. That's really telling us all we need to know.
You know, I mean, and Buddy and Eric, you all would remember all those times when you had a Democrat standing up and saying, I didn't leave the Democratic Party, the Democratic Party left me. Well, guess what? Well, we're going to be hearing, I didn't leave the GOP, the GOP has left me.
And you know what's interesting, Eric? I think Danny Porter... I don't know. I don't look at poll. I'm not sure there is polling about approval, disapproval. But he's been a very successful district attorney for the county. It isn't as if there are people who are, you know, moving to really push him out, except maybe because he's got the wrong party label now.
Well, and I, you know, to your point, Jim, you know, it's not as though he made that statement. To me, it came across as opportunistic, right, in that he just wants to run another term. He thinks he has a better shot getting elected.
Well, yeah,
as a Democrat.
Well, yeah, but sure. But with that, when you had Democrats switching to the Republican Party, that's exactly what it was too.
Well, but they talked about how they believed in the Republican ideals.
Oh, yes, I'm sure that there will be, if Porter makes that call, there'll be some conversation in that sense, too.
But I've got something to add here. When I saw that, of course, I contacted a friend of mine who's a newly elected state senator out there and said, Danny Porter's a good man. He's been a good district attorney. You're going to reach out to him and maybe see if you can welcome him to the fold. And she said, well, the problem is this. When I was running for the Senate this past fall, not only did he campaign against me, but he did a TV ad against me. So yeah, it kind of puts him in a bad situation, because I would love to see the Democratic Party welcome him, because I think he's been a very positive force in law enforcement in this state for a number of years. But at the same time, you've got Democrats who also want to run for district attorney in a primary. So could he get out of a primary? That's right. The problem, yeah, right there.
And I think the big question is that since it doesn't look like he's made an ideological shift, especially on the types of criminal justice issues that might animate Democratic voters in the county, right, then I think it does actually look more opportunistic as opposed to the party passing by, because he still seems pretty conservative. He still seems, yeah, you know, just in practice to still be a Republican. And so what does it look like if you're donning the Democratic mantle at the last minute in order to, you know, be more acceptable to the changing demographics of the county?
To Buddy's point, the last major convert that Republicans got from a sitting Democrat was Ashley Bell, up one county up in Hall County. He was a county commissioner. It was 2014. He switched. He came up for re-election 2 years later. He couldn't get out of a GOP primary.
African-American.
He was African-American, but there was also a lot of resentment that, you know, here was a newcomer trying to take advantage.
But let's first of all make sure we say this was apparently mentioned in a longer conversation.
The trial balloon. Yeah.
Yes. He has not firmly said, I'm switching parties here. And I would say that Eric, your point, I think, is well taken. I think recalling back when Sonny Perdue was a Democrat, back when Nathan Deal was a Democrat, two of the most prominent examples of people who switched parties, I do think you make a point when you say there were ideological underpinnings for their move. It isn't as, and so it therefore supported that quote, I didn't leave the Democratic Party, the Democratic Party left me. Although I'm not sure it's as true in Georgia politics as it would have been if they had been in, say, Illinois, you know?
Yeah, I do think that he probably needs to sort of clarify his comments pretty quickly, because just leaving that hanging out there on both sides, you're going to create some confusion.
On a related note, I think most of you are aware that two of our Republican office holders finally succeeded in having their offices made nonpartisan this year by act of the legislature. One is our magistrate judge, and also our probate judge will now be nonpartisan at the next election.
This is Justin Cobb County.
Justin Cobb County, yes. We tried to do it when the Republicans were in charge, but had no success. But now, all of a sudden, our legislature has seen the light now. And fortunately, I'm glad. I think it's good government. I think those two offices ought to be nonpartisan. I think this is probably the people will come out ahead here.
So there's another interesting story out of Gwinnett that's on the other side of this coin, Andra. Butch Conway, the longtime sheriff up there, tough law and order guy, has been for years. He has been a part of the ICE program, 287G is the formal name for it, in which local authorities make a deal with ICE, Immigration Enforcement, that they will turn over undocumented immigrants who are arrested to the feds. And Conway, despite the change in the climate up there, made it clear the other day when this agreement comes up in June, he has every intention of renewing it.
Yeah, and I think that that might actually be evidence of a little bit of tone deafness there. So, you might want to sort of, law and order works very well here. He's probably looking at Governor Kemp and is seeing how sort of him going to the right on immigration, helped him to win the governorship. But he forgot that Governor Kemp did not win Gwinnett County. And then also looking at the fact that a quarter of the population of Gwinnett County is foreign born. This is an issue that's going to be really near and dear to a lot of people's hearts, both immigrant and non-immigrant. Like, you don't want to be characterized as the Joe Arpaio of Georgia, and that's the road that he's heading on. And so I don't necessarily know if this is the most effective thing for him to do.
Here's what he's doing. He's manipulating to get in a position where he can be appointed to a statewide law enforcement position. And just like our wonderful district attorney, Vic Reynolds, left the DA's job to come have the GBI, I think it was a great step for him. And I think this is what Sheriff Conway has in mind.
Yeah, he is not committed to re-election in 2020.
Right, exactly. But Democrats are already lining up saying they want to run against him up there. I wonder, in a guy like Butch Conway, it's interesting, Andra compares him, say, in a way to Joe Arpaio, where he says shouldn't go that route. I wonder if Conway is simply too hard-headed and fixed in his ways about immigration to want to make a political calculation
I think that's probably the case. And you do have the same situation building in Cobb County, where you've got Neil Warren seeking another term. He has also signed on with 287G. I don't know if they're close to the end of their contract or not.
He has been noticeably silent about these issues, though, as opposed to Sheriff Conway, who has been quite outspoken. So we'll be watching to see what my friend Sheriff Neil Warren does. And he's been a good sheriff. However, I think he sees the time changing.
All right, let's move on to yet another story that Gwinnett County is deeply involved in. It's not, Gwinnett is not the entire 7th District, congressional district, but it makes up a big part of it. Eric, this week, we got a new Democratic contender in the race, Brenda Lopez, who is the first Latina to declare officially her candidacy for a congressional seat in Georgia. She's been a state rep, of course. So she's in the race. Carolyn Bordeaux on the Democratic side is in the race. We got several candidates on the Democratic side.
John Eves.
John Eves is moving up there to the 7th, a former Fulton County Commission chair. So there's lots of, all right. We may have been doing you a disservice the last couple of shows when we've talked about a Republican entrant into that contest, Lynn Hamrick. Mm-hmm. Lynn Hamrick she's been a Home Depot executive. Her husband works for Arthur Blank, runs his for-profit company, the Falcons, the Atlanta United. And we've said that you sent out a lot of tweets on the weekend before she announced that we thought meant that you were working specifically on her behalf. Mm-hmm. I just want to make sure that you get a chance to tell us where you really are, because we may have mischaracterized you without meeting.
Yeah, no, I just got tipped off before the weekend before she announced that she was going to announce.
I thought there were some exclamation points in those tweets.
Well, there were. I mean, I
want you. You sensed a little thrill in the tweet.
Well, there was a thrill in that. I think it's known that I'm very engaged in recruiting women, Republican women, to run for office. That's a big passion of mine. I think that Republicans have to recruit more women. And, whenever a woman steps forward, a qualified woman to run for office, I'm all for it. And I happen to know Lynn personally. And when I heard that she was going to run, I was very excited about it. I also have a long history with Renee Unterman. I'm thrilled to death that we have two women that are running in that primary.
Yeah, Todd Rehm, who's worked with her for a very long time, said on the show Wednesday, left very little doubt that Unterman's going to get into this race. She, of course, a Republican member of the state Senate, was treated very badly by the men on the Republican side in the Senate. They stripped her of a very important committee chairmanship. And it's pretty clear she's going to jump into this thing as well.
Although she's a good soldier. She's a good soldier.
Yeah, and
she
I will say, too,
carried
that,
the ball.
Yeah, I mean, I think she started off the session, maybe it was a little rough, but I think she ended the session working very closely with the Senate leadership. And quite honestly, she represents 50% of the women, Republican women in the state Senate. I hate the fact that she's leaving. I'd love for her to stay in the Senate because I think we need more women in the Senate. And if she is leaving that Senate seat, I hope Republican women run for it.
Well, you know, one of the things I think that's interesting between these two women is where they're going to position themselves ideologically and what is most congruent with that district. And so when we've been thinking about those North Metro districts, particularly the 6th and the 7th district, and we're thinking about them as being more moderate districts. And so Hamrick has taken this conservative vote, so she's going to be perceived rightly or wrongly as the more conservative of the two candidates. So the question for me is whether or not Unterman is actually in the stronger position because of the fact that she's had to fight the male leadership in the Senate, because she's spoken out in favor of Me Too, because of the work that she did on rape kits. That might be the type of thing that might actually appeal to college-educated suburban women in those districts.
But she also carried HB 481.
Right.
Yeah.
So and I wonder how that's going to play out. You've talked to Ms. Hamrick, Eric. Did she mention that bill?
I didn't discuss that particular bill with her. But let's make sure
it was Renee Unterman who carried 481. Lynn Hamrick had nothing to do. I just want to make sure that third person pronoun is not misinterpreted.
I may be more close to Senate record, but if I look at Renee Unterman's career, at least in my impression of her, she's very conservative.
Yeah, buddy, I don't know how you even look past 481 if you're a female voter. And if the voters are, as Andra says, more moderate up in Gwinnett, how do you even look beyond 481 to examine the rest of her career?
It's going to be the centerpiece for a lot of Democratic campaigns coming up this year. And I don't think anybody can be oblivious to it. I think Renee Unterman, Senator Unterman, either lives or dies by her participation in this bill. It might be good to get her through a Republican primary, and maybe that's what she's banking on, but I think it would have serious consequences when it came to a general election.
And that's my point. I think I'm talking about the primary, and I think you are looking ahead to the general election. And so it would, but I would say that both of these candidates would have a problem if you're looking for, the sort of wide sort of birth of sort of who actually lives in that district now.
Right.
But in terms of getting out of the primary, for some of those suburban women who may have stayed home in 2016, who may have, voted for Carolyn Bordeaux, who would vote in a Republican primary, I do wonder if Renee Unterman can actually use some of her challenges with the male leadership in order to be able to ride that to the nomination.
Yeah, I mean, the organization and money is going to be key in this race, too. Yeah. And, while Renee Unterman's been in the Senate, she's got an organization. I don't believe she's had a competitive race, for the last several years. But you're going to have to raise a lot of money for both the primary and then for the general election, because this is going to be a competitive race.
But remember years ago when Renee Unterman got into the Senate, that Senate race was, I think, the most expensive legislative race on record at the time.
Really?
How many years ago was that?
Yeah, that was a good while ago.
Yeah,
it was, but I remember it as well. Jim and I have been around a while, and I submit to you that it was not only expensive, it was mean and nasty.
Yeah.
All right, let me look at one other aspect of the 7th District, but actually the whole ticket in 2020, in races in Georgia. Eric, before the show today, you said to me, gee, can we spend a minute talking about the absence of Stacey Abrams as a candidate for Senate on the general election ballot now? What that impact is going to be for candidates for 7th District, for 6th District. She did propel a lot of Democrats to go to the polls in 2018, and you believe that her absence is going to hurt the Democratic Party.
Absolutely, in particular in the metro area. Republicans lost a number of legislative seats. They lost the 6th District congressional seat. They almost lost the 7th congressional seat. And I think a lot of that had to do with the energy that was behind the Abrams campaign. And she spent a lot of time mobilizing people in Metro Atlanta. And she is now not going to be on the ticket. And I'm sure there'll be, you know, a strong Democrat on the ticket, but I don't think they're going to be as strong as someone like Stacey Abrams, who would have had a big effect on mobilizing all of those Democratic voters and even independent women that she turned out.
So even with the fact that it will be President Trump who will be on the very top of the ticket, and I would think that his presence is either going to entice those people who are strongly behind him. But aren't the people in the 6th and 7th who do not want Donald Trump to win a second term going to turn out anyway?
Donald Trump will be a driving force. But I agree with Eric to this extent. For the last 2 years, you've had Stacey Abrams kind of becoming the face of the Democratic Party. I mean, I'm not saying it's a cult of personality, but she became... She and the state Democratic Party were so closely identified. Now she's pulling away, and you wonder why, if the state Democratic Party was prepared and had somebody ready to step into that vacuum.
So, I mean, I think the big question for this to determine whether or not this was a cult of personality is whether or not the infrastructure stays. Mm-hmm. So Abrams has made a claim that she has built an infrastructure in the state of Georgia. She sold this to the DNC. If that's true, then the mobilization campaign should go on without her being there. Yeah, you don't get the same type of earned media. You don't get the same type of attention, but the drill is, can you get people on the doors to tell people to turn out to vote and then get those people?
Well, I think the top of the ticket's going to matter, who the Democrats nominate for president. That will have a big impact. And let's also not forget the fact that David Perdue, his numbers are actually pretty decent in Metro Atlanta, and he's working hard in Metro Atlanta and is showing up, and he's going to be out there and he's going to be paying a lot of attention.
Buddy, you get the last word before the break.
The one thing that Stacey Abrams brought to the Democrats was intensity, and elections are about intensity, and I agree to a certain extent with Eric in that we won't have that same level of intensity. However, I'm hoping that what Dr. Gillespie has said is true in that we've built the infrastructure and we've gotten to a certain point now and we can build on that. So I think it's a legitimate question, a legitimate discussion to be determined.
Andre, you get the last word before the break.
So all I want to say is that while empirically vice presidential picks don't matter, I feel pretty certain that Stacey Abrams is likely, if she doesn't run for president herself, but even if she did, to end up on the short list for VP.
Okay, but what if Kamala Harris is the nominee? Do you think there'll be two?
I said short list. I didn't necessarily say they were going to
be. Well, we have more than enough time. We have plenty of time to talk about that in the months ahead. Right now, we got to get to a break. We'll do that and be back with more on Political Rewind.
Welcome to GPB's Stealth Drive, an innovative way we're fundraising on the air this spring. The bottom line is, you get more of the programs you come to GPB for and less fundraising on the air. But it will only work when listeners like you keep GPB strong. The best way to do that is to join us as a GPB sustainer. Your ongoing monthly contribution provides a steady stream of support for the programs you enjoy. Donate at gpb.org or 800-222-4788. And thanks.
I'm Ira Flatow. On the next Science Friday, a new look at how the brain sees, an explanation of how caricatures became such a popular art form, and the 18th century scientist whose travels convinced him that humans were changing the climate for the worse. It's likely you've never heard of Alexander von Humboldt. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
3 o'clock this afternoon on GPB.
We're back on Political Rewind. We're back with you on the show. Before the show's over today, we're going to let you know about where we're taking our show on the road, where we're going to be next. Our senior producer, Tom Faust, thinks you can hardly wait for that announcement. So hang on. It'll be coming soon. Jim Galloway, your jolt pointed out the other day, yesterday maybe, that here's an example of David Ralston cannot quite put this controversy over how his work as speaker and how his work as an attorney representing clients have intermingled in ways that some people are very concerned about. This last week, the Gainesville Times, a relatively major newspaper, I suppose, it's up there in a big part of the state, editorialized that it was time for him to step down. Let's just read one quick part of what that editorial said. He, meaning Ralston, does not understand that he has squandered the trust of those who selected him to fill the position many feel to be the second most powerful in state government, and because he does not understand, he should no longer be in that position. Now, the Gainesville Times isn't going to determine his future, but the fact that this will not quite go away is really unsettling for a David Ralston.
Right. Now, and this is all about how his private law practice, yeah, and accusations that he has used that law practice, used his legislative position to advantage his clients by delaying court cases. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting, this, a lot of newspapers in Georgia have kind of shied away from opinion journalism. The AJC has reduced its editorial footprint. The Gainesville Times, for the last decade, has been this uniquely positioned newspaper because it's in Hall County in Gainesville.
Yeah.
Nathan Deal was a native of Hall County. Casey Cagle, the lieutenant governor, lived there. Butch Miller, who is now president pro tem of the Senate, he lives there. And Ralston is just on the edge of the Gainesville circulation area. So I think it does carry some clout when your hometown paper, and Ralston used to work for that newspaper.
Yeah, he was a young kid
in the newsroom.
So where are we headed? I mean, this is not going away, Eric Tannenblatt.
Well, it's going to be up to the members of the caucus.
Right.
And, this is not an election year, so it's not as if the speaker's going in and, helping to raise money for all the candidates that are out there. And I guess you'll see over the summer if the caucus, if this dies down or not, or if things like what you saw in the Gainesville Times continues to bubble up.
I find it a little hard to, if this thing didn't grow in intensity during the session, if Ralston hadn't gone to the well, tried to make amends, tried to put in place some rules that he thought would change this, but if it didn't bubble up in a way that cost him his job as speaker, at least, this past session, I find it hard to imagine it's going to grow to be a big, big controversy in 2020's session.
Well, having been a lawyer in the General Assembly of Georgia, I took advantage of a provision that allowed me to stay out of court 3 weeks after I got out of the session, and of course during the session. However, it's gotten to be so broad now that I think some people have probably taking unfair advantage of the situation.
Do you think Ralston has?
And I don't know. I haven't studied that carefully. I will say this. He needs to get his business in order. I'm a friend of David Ralston, and I think he's done a lot of good things for the state. But at the same time, he needs to hire somebody to come in there and look after his business. You know, his former law partner, Amanda Mercier, is now in the Court of Appeals. And in a place like up in Blue Ridge, you don't have that many lawyers, and he's got to get in there and get somebody to run his business.
You know, there are two places where Ralston might need to worry about this, and three places: his own reelection bid next mm-hmm. May. He has to worry if House Republican incumbents face primary challenges and he becomes an issue in those primary
right.
challenges, which I think is probably the greatest danger. And then in a November election, whether there'll be enough, whether Democratic challengers to House Republicans might bring that up.
Yeah, who knows, Andra, how many Democrats are going to be... I'm sorry. We're talking about 2021, not 2020. Just a little senior moment there. Anyhow, this hasn't gone away for Ralston.
It hasn't gone away, and I just would think from a PR standpoint about what would be the best way to dispatch with this issue. So I agree with Congressman Darden and have said so on this show. Like, he needs to handle his business and hire junior partners to help him with the business to make sure that his cases can go on even when he is not in a capacity, and I think he needs to publicly sort of announce those things as a signal that he has heard the critique and that, he is willing to sort of behave differently.
And he did during the session, step forward after, this came to light and took action. The legislature passed legislation. We don't know what he has done since the legislature, right. And it's very possible that he has.
All right.
What about this FBI agent, former FBI agent that was came in and did this analysis? Was that hired by somebody that we know of?
It was a private investigator.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we weren't. The problem is, no one has independently verified what he says he discovered, which was many, many examples of Ralston abusing this privilege. All right, a couple of quick items because we're running short on time. First of all, Jim, there seems to be some actual movement on a compromise between at least Senate Republicans and Democrats over this Hurricane Michael and other emergency relief funds. The Senate is now promising additional aid of $300 million for Puerto Rico.
And you've got Republican senators, including Isaacson and Perdue, working very hard to make sure that President Trump doesn't bolt.
Mm-hmm. At which, of course, we don't know, do we?
I think that's the wild card.
Yeah.
So, it was really interesting to see what Senator Perdue said in the National Press and the Washington Post versus what he said in the AJC. But, like, between his comments and Senator Leahy's comments, it looks like there is some bipartisan movement to making sure that everybody gets the disaster funding that they need. And I think the big wild card question is what the president does.
Yeah, we'll wrap on David Perdue, and we all know it. There's no point in acting like it's not there. It's who you're loyal to, President of the United States or the people of Southwest Georgia. And he might have to make a tough decision here. And if I know David Perdue and being astute enough, sometimes it might be time to cut the president.
Well, but that presumes the president isn't going to go along with this,
Yeah. Eric. I think the president was going along with it, and then Senator Schumer, ratcheted up his demands. So, David Perdue knows his priorities are the constituents of Georgia. I think that's the way he's conducted himself. He has a good relationship with the president. I think we would want our United States senator to have a good relationship with the president. And just as we just talked about, we need Senator Isaacson and Senator Perdue to keep the president in check with this compromise.
Look, the politics aside, the farmers in South Georgia need this money.
Right.
And by the way,
because
Twitter it can be such a really lovely, positive medium. I took a lot of heat the other day when I talked about how much South Georgia needs the help, and I was upbraided for not pointing out that Puerto Rico does too. It does. So we hope it works successfully for everybody. Finally, Jim, we only have a couple minutes for this, but an interesting item today. We've seen Johnny Isaacson sort of try to go his own way in a number of instances when it comes to President Trump. And now he's done it. He apparently was in a meeting with the president and a few other Republican senators the other day, urging the president not to go ahead and impose auto tariffs on cars brought in from outside this country, saying it would be bad for the economy, bad for jobs, and that sort of thing. Here's again Isaacson sort of staking out an independent position.
Yeah, he's you've got President Trump, who is behaving as if Detroit is the same Detroit that it was in the 1950s and 60s. And Georgia and much of the rest of the Southeast has developed this automotive production system that relies heavily on imports of parts. It's a very, very much, it's cross-border intensive. And I would point to that I would say that Isaacson is probably looking out for Georgia Republicans at this point, because what's headquartered in Sandy Springs?
Mercedes-Benz.
Porsche
in South Atlanta.
And you've got a very determined effort by Karen Handel to retake that 6th district seat.
Yeah,
it could figure in.
All right, that brings us to the end of our show today. We're really completely out of time. Buddy Darden, Eric Tannenblatt, Dr. Andre Gillespie, Jim Galloway, I really enjoyed having you here. Jim, you're going to be back with me on Monday at 2 o'clock. And one of these we'll talk about is that we'll have given people a chance to read your column on Robert Benham. And we'll talk a little bit about some of the great nuggets from your interview with
him. It's got a couple Easter eggs in there.
It's really interesting. All right, a couple of items before we go. First of all, we want to thank Morgan Carter. She has been an intern with us for the last more than semester. She's a teacher up at Kennesaw State. She completed her master's degree. She had her orals last week. She passed with flying colors. And now she heads off into the world with a master's degree. We're just waiting for the PhD to come next, Morgan. But thank you for everything you've done for us on Political Rewind during your time here. We really will miss you. Now, one other item. We're all set to go on the road again. We always enjoy getting out to do the show in front of live audiences, and you are so receptive and been so great to welcome us. Our next show on the road has now been planned. On Monday night, June 3rd, we're going to be in Cartersville, Georgia at the Grand Theater, 7 o'clock, Monday night the 3rd. You can get tickets. They're free, but we want you to reserve them, so there's definitely a seat for you. Just go to politicalrewind.org, click on the link, and save your ticket so you can come join us for our show up in Cartersville, Georgia. So that's it for us for today. Thanks so much for all you've been doing in terms of being listeners to this show, watching us when our show is on TV on Sunday morning. And one last time, I want to tell you how thrilled all of us are. Tom Faust, Robert Jimison, myself, Taya Ryan, our president and CEO, Sarah Shariari, our managing editor, when we found out that you have put us in the top 20 podcasts in the United States because you like Political Rewind so much. Thank you so much. And I'm talking NPR podcasts. Don't tweet me about that. Thanks a lot for being with us. See you again Monday at 2.
Oh, that's great.